This is an ABC podcast.
How many times have you paid with cash recently? I'm guessing the answer's not very many. And even if you wanted to, most of the time you'd now be met with this.
And do you take cash?
We don't.
Cash seems to be less popular than ever. So is it a thing of the past? And if it is, what does that mean for the future? I'm Edwina Stott, and this is Future Tense. You might have seen fewer dollar notes being handed over cash registers, but that doesn't mean cash isn't in demand.
The RBA and other banks globally have noted a drastic increase in the amount of cash in circulation.
Chris Vasant-Kumar is a lecturer in anthropology at Macquarie University's School of Social Science. He says to understand why there's now more cash in circulation, it is important to consider the four ways in which money is used.
There's the money as a means of exchange, money as unit of account, money as store of value, and money as standard of payment, right? Most of the conversation we have about cash focuses on that means of exchange function.
Buying you groceries at the supermarket, for example.
And in terms of using cash that way, that has been decreasing for years, and that has decreased even further since the pandemic started, right? But if we're thinking about why is there so much more cash in circulation since the pandemic has started, some folks will call it hoarding, but it's really better to think about it in terms of the store of value function of money. And so in that context, there's a whole group of folks in Australian society for whom the actual physical cash provides an important sense of security. They're not going out and spending it, but and they're probably not keeping it in their pillowcase or under their mattress, but they are keeping it around.
And of course, attitudes to money vary. Chris says in Germany, for example, cash is still king in every part of the economy.
Why? Because once upon a time in East Germany, when there was this, communist surveillance state, people couldn't conduct their business without, the government prying into their life, right? So it's different between countries, and it's also different within countries, right? So you have, in Australian society, different generations may well have different attitudes towards physical money versus digital money. Folks who live in cities as opposed to, remote areas, people with different relationships to technology, migrants, there's a broad spectrum of attitudes towards money. But yeah, absolutely, for at least some subset of the population, that access to physical money has really been a key sort of security blanket, right? I mean, if you watch the Charlie Brown cartoon, Lucy's always trying to get Linus rid of the blanket, but getting rid of that blanket is potentially problematic for those people for whom it matters, right? And so I think, how do we do this without destabilizing certain elements of economic life is a big question you have to ask ourselves.
One country we could look to for the answer to that question is Sweden.
It looked like a commando operation. The helicopter had been stolen from a local airport. The thieves were lowered on ropes onto the roof of the building. The few eyewitnesses said they heard the robbers blast their way in.
The country's big push towards a cashless society was in part spurred on by this helicopter bank robbery in 2009. It was one of a number of robberies in the mid to late 2000s where shops, banks and buses were targeted. It spurred unions to campaign against cash in order to protect their workers. And over a decade after the heist, Sweden is still set on a cashless society. But things are starting to slow.
And in the last couple of years, there's kind of been a retrenchment. And there's been legislation passed that says, for example, bank branches have to have cash available, right? But there's been this movement away from a kind of a headlong rush towards going cashless. Part of it has been lobbying by the cash handling industry. So like one of the things that if you look at the debate about the persistence of cash or going cashless, in some ways it's kind of a proxy battle between the companies that have the most to gain from either way or either outcome. But there's also a real discussion about inclusion. And there has been some significant pushback in terms of let's think about who are the groups of people in a society that might be potentially marginalized by a rapid movement to an entirely cashless society. And so, it's still, Sweden is still highly cashless, right? So it's not that there's really been a huge sort of rollback of a movement towards a cashless society. But there's been this kind of growing awareness that, okay, yes, we're going cashless, but also at the same time, let's think about ways of building inclusion into this process so that, you know, some of those groups I mentioned before, the older folks living in the countryside, the new migrants, et cetera, are not going to be overly disenfranchised or have, you know, suffer some sort of impact on their well-being because of this process.
The other country we should take a look at when we're thinking about how a cashless future might work is Zimbabwe. In the space of just 2 years, Zimbabwe's economy moved from one that was almost entirely cash to one that was 96% cashless.
So this is between about 2016 and 2018. And so for me, this is kind of, it's a cautionary story because nobody really wanted to do this, right? And the key driver for this was Zimbabwe had to dollarize, effectively dollarize, after the hyperinflation that happened in 07, 08, 09. And the US dollar became sort of, you know, the same way that folks now have confidence in physical cash, some folks have confidence in physical cash as this, you know, security blanket, as this way we store value, the US dollar became that for many Zimbabweans. Unfortunately, you know, Zimbabwe being Zimbabwe and not the US, they couldn't print their own dollars. And so there was a massive cash shortage. And as a result, you know, you have this very quick and very large scale move to electronic transactions, mostly through the medium of mobile money. So they've gone to mobile money. And the big issue has been, even though they shifted to mobile money, everybody still wanted to have US dollars. So no one could get their hands on the physical money. And folks felt like they were kind of transacting with play money because it wasn't the stuff they actually wanted. And so there was this real sort of ongoing crisis of faith in money itself. But, you know, if you go back to the 1980s, Zimbabwe was a very wealthy country, highly developed and fairly stable economically. You know, we hope that Australian society, Australian economic life will not be disrupted in the way that, you know, has happened there. But I think it's a cautionary tale in the sense that when you're transitioning from one kind of money to another, you have to be very careful to get buy-in from the folks who are using these new kinds of money. Don't destabilize things by moving too quickly.
It's not just the process of transitioning to a cashless future that's raising concerns, though. There's also the question of what we may be leaving behind. Physical cash offers one fundamental benefit that a digital alternative could make a thing of the past.
When we think about using, in my case, a $20 bill and going to pay for something at a store with that, when I hand that bill over to the merchant doesn't know anything about me. The merchant doesn't know my birth date, my spending habits, my address, my telephone number, my email. The merchant gets paid and I move along on my way. And that was kind of the sort of way of society for a long time. You know, even checks, which obviously became quite dominant over the last 100 years, didn't have that much revealing information.
Alex Gladstein is the chief strategy officer at the Human Rights Foundation.
So you went from having notes and coins, which are essentially anonymous, to having checks. And, you know, at that point in the 1970s was when a lot of this regulation around money started to take place. In America, we got the Bank Secrecy Act, and we had a lot of regulation around, like, banks and other kind of money transmitters needing to give information about their clients to the government. And, you know, even then you can go back and look at the court cases in the 1970s in the United States, and you can look at the dissent that the Supreme Court justices who lost said at the time. And they were like worried basically about a surveillance state, even in a world which barely had credit cards, right? Okay, fast forward to now. I mean, people use tapping and swiping and they have chips, and every time you make a transaction with someone at the store or online, you reveal this like enormous amount of information about yourself. You add to like a digital history of yourself. You allow third-party companies and governments to know exactly what you're doing. So the gap in privacy and freedom between using cash and using a credit card or fintech, like, you know, whether it's Alipay or Apple Pay or whatever, is just enormous.
And I suppose the argument that most people would make then is, why does it matter? Why does it matter that people know which coffee shop I go to or what I buy on Amazon? Or, you know, is it ever really going to come up back on me? Does it even matter that people know this information?
Yeah, sure. Look, I think it's a trade-off between privacy and freedom and comfort and convenience. And that has gone to an extreme on the comfort and convenience side in China, for example, where, you know, all rights and freedoms are given up for apps and a kind of social technology system that knows like everything about you in real time, right? And, you know, why does it matter? Well, when these systems become so powerful, it allows, whether it's corporations or governments, to do a whole range of new things. Now they can do instant analysis and surveillance. They can do censorship. They can enforce blacklists really easily. They can target people due to their identity, sexual orientation, gender, ethnicity, religion, etc. They can start to socially engineer society if they have kind of control over the payments, transactions, etc. And I think that that's a real concern.
You're with Future Tense on RN, ABC Radio National, exploring the world around us, looking for the pathways ahead, and signposting the future.
As we move away from cash for everyday transactions and become more comfortable with the idea of digital money, so too are our governments. There are now 9 countries globally who have launched their own central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs.
A central bank digital currency is basically a government-issued type of money that is purely electronic in nature.
Lynn Alden is a macroeconomist and investment strategist.
So right now, you know, we have obviously physical currency, but then also we have, you know, most of our currency is digital in banks. However, it's not really a digital currency in the sense it's not digitally native. It's in someone's ledger, kind of that bank's own private ledger. And central bank digital currencies potentially represent a way to replace cash, a way to transfer value electronically in a similar way that you would with small transactions for cash. And so, for example, there are different versions of it, but essentially, you know, individuals can have an account directly with their government central bank. That CBDC would be a liability of the central bank in a similar way that physical banknotes are, but it's electronic.
There's a crucial point to make here, and that is that CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, are not cryptocurrencies. Cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are stored on a decentralized blockchain and so cannot be controlled by any one person or authority. CBDCs, however, are regulated and controlled by the issuing authority, or the central bank. Late last year, the Reserve Bank of Australia published a report on its 2-year research project into CBDCs for wholesale use. This is things like interbank transfers and transactions between financial institutions. It found that wholesale CBDCs could increase efficiency and reduce risk by replacing paper-based processes.
And so right now, global payments are rather centralized through certain channels. And central bank digital currencies represent basically a more peer-to-peer way of doing it, even just peer-to-peer between different central banks rather than all going through certain hubs.
And there are also potential benefits to us as individuals when it comes to CBDCs.
One of the advantages of digital currencies in general, including central bank digital currencies, is that they can bank the unbanked. And so in many emerging markets, there's still rather low bank penetration rates. Even in developed markets, there are some segments of society that don't have banking access. And it represents a way to have those small account holders be able to safely store value.
Why would that be so beneficial for governments to be able to make sure that everybody was banked?
So, I mean, access to basic banking services is a very important part of economic development. The ability to take out loans for a mortgage and basically overall kind of small business loans are an important part of economic growth, at least in the way that the system's currently designed. In addition, you know, when people have small amounts of cash, it's just safer to hold it with someone rather than have it physically. And so, again, it's something that from a place of privilege is something we don't necessarily think about. But in a lot of markets, that's important. There are people that are, you know, some countries have 10, 20, 30% or more of the population that does not have a banking account. And so really basic services like receiving payments, sending payments, especially in a very digitized world, is important.
Are there any other benefits that people might be able to take advantage of if a CBDC was introduced?
In certain kind of recessionary environments, it's potentially a way to distribute payments easier. In the United States, for example, we had challenges where, you know, we sent out stimulus checks to households under a certain income limit. And ironically, the people that were generally needed it the most had sometimes were the last to get it. They were the slowest to get it because they had to be physically mailed checks, and it was tough to track down their address. Whereas if they already had an existing wallet, a digital wallet with their central bank, they'd be able to get faster payments. And so there obviously are technical advantages to it. And I think that's how they would potentially draw people into the system, is basically introducing some sort of stimulus check that you could sign up to receive for. And I just think that the caveat that is people should be aware of some of the privacy concerns and challenges around that. So it's going to be a trade-off, I think, going forward.
This ability to send and receive payments more easily and effectively isn't just beneficial for individuals. It has huge implications for the way in which an entire nation's economy can be controlled. Nick Bhatia is an adjunct professor at USC Marshall School of Business and the author of Layered Money.
It benefits the public because when the Fed wants to conduct monetary stimulus, it has a new option, which is direct to the public. So a new type of monetary stimulus that actually goes to the retail side of the banking system instead of purely to the wholesale side, which is what quantitative easing is. It's also what lowering interest rates does. And then another benefit is just a cleaner, more efficient wholesale system. So replacing Fedwire with a more distributed ledger type of technology would be more efficient. I traded bonds for several years, and I traded money markets as well. And I've worked in trading operations, so I've seen securities faxed to each other on a daily basis in the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. So I know how archaic the current financial system architecture is as well. So these are some of the potential benefits for the system that I see as reasons why we'll definitely see CBDCs being launched.
Nick argues that this doesn't mean we'll see CBDCs replace the commercial banking system in every country, though.
For one reason, more than anything else, which is that credit comes from commercial banks. Money is lent at the commercial banking level into the economy through mortgages and small business loans and personal loans, auto loans, etc. The commercial banks are the ones that issue those deposits and create that money and mark assets on their balance sheet in the form of loans to their customers. That function of credit creation cannot change here in the United States. Cannot change. It is interwoven to the fabric of society, to the government, to the way the whole country works, to the way the whole global financial system works. That is not going away. So a central bank digital currency that's retail facing does not mean the end of commercial banks. It does not mean the end of your Wells Fargo deposit. It will probably become Wells Fargo coin in the future instead of deposit as we modernize the whole infrastructure and interoperability becomes more of an issue. This is that 5 to 10 year future that we're looking at here. But no, the commercial banking system is not going away. Absolutely will not happen in the United States. Very unlikely to happen in Australia and Europe, for example, and then England and Canada as well. You know, these Western central banks, New Zealand, of course, as well. Very unlikely. Based on what I'm reading from the ECB in their capped limits, this idea of credit creation being at the center of how economies work is not going to be ignored by central banks.
This may not be true of all governments, though. For a regime like China's, there are huge benefits to controlling the whole financial system.
I study the Politburo and I try to study the CCP and their history and their motivations, because for us in the West, it's hard to grasp China's history, culture, motivations, and you know, what they're going to do on the geopolitical stage. But I do know from, you know, being on this planet for a few decades that trying to see where China is going to help you figure out geopolitical trends. Okay. And what I see from China is a centralization of power. Let's just say in a very Chinese way, it is something that they are doing in their own way. He has these principles with Chinese characteristics and how they're trying to build the party's future is all very highly scripted. And Xi Jinping is showing this desire to be at the Mao level from the China historical perspective and superseding Deng Xiaoping and all rulers between the 70s and today. And then basically, you know, going between Mao to Xi. And so there's a huge overarching centralization of power and geopolitical theme here in China that is impossible for me to try and get ahead of and predict, let's say.
Regardless of their ability to modernize existing financial infrastructure, Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation argues CBDC should be approached with caution. He says these benefits come at a cost.
Yeah, sure. Look, I think it's a trade-off between privacy and freedom and comfort and convenience.
CBDCs could give governments an entirely new level of financial control.
For example, expiration dates on money. So you could like make wages and like the government could say you got to spend it in the next 60 days. Basically, they can like fight savings and impose negative interest rates, things like that. So central bank digital currencies at a time when, you know, governments are involved in this like super loose monetary policy, very low interest rate era where they're coming up against the lower bound, this idea of like zero interest rate policy. Well, this would allow them to kind of fight their biggest obstacle, which is the citizen. So the citizen in many countries in times like this says, hey, I want cash. I want to like literally have cash. I'm going to like earn my money and I'm going to withdraw it from the bank. And this would make that impossible, right? So if you've got a CBDC, you can no longer withdraw your money from an ATM. Like it's always going to live in this wallet that the government can freeze, censor, do whatever it wants with, right? It could put an expiration date on it. So you're talking about a future where our freedoms are continually stripped from us. Cash actually helps protect you from the authorities. Like again, it is something that is so important for so many millions of people. And in the West or in Australia, you know, we may be missing this a little bit because we're in our little financial bubble and we have a good currency and a good banking system, et cetera, right? Relatively speaking. But we miss the fact that in a lot of countries, cash is like a last bastion of freedom. Like take, for example, in the West Bank, Palestinians, like, you know, they like using cash because it allows them to kind of escape like this repressive tactics of whether it be the Israeli military or the very corrupt Palestinian authority. So they like having cash, right? And if the UN comes to the PA, the Palestinian Authority, in the next couple of years and says, look, we're going to make a Palestine coin and it's going to be great. It's going to be the central bank digital currency. That's not going to be great for Palestinians. Like, number one, no one's going to buy it. It's probably not going to be worth very much, right? And secondly, it's going to destroy privacy and freedom.
So is there a way to achieve the benefits of CBDCs without sacrificing our privacy? Microeconomist Lynn Alden says there are some alternatives.
Well, central bank digital currencies were kind of initially inspired by Bitcoin. That was kind of the foundational technology that led to some of this happening. And so, you know, Bitcoin was invented in 2008, launched in early 2009. So that was the genesis digital currency, at least the first successful one. There were kind of proto attempts before that in different environments. And so that represents a private digital currency that basically governments don't have the ability to censor transactions. And however, it is rather transparent. It can be monitored pretty closely. And so that's one of the alternatives that people have had for about 13 years now.
Most of us have now heard of Bitcoin. Whether or not we completely understand it is another matter. But one of the big things we know about Bitcoin is that its price is incredibly volatile. This is where another kind of digital currency called a stablecoin could come in.
And these are also kind of an inspiration for central bank digital currencies over the years. And that's where an entity can collect currency, could be dollars, could be another currency, any fiat currency, and they issue tokens on a blockchain that represent redeemable units of that currency. And in the early days, because crypto companies had trouble getting banking relationships, but we are starting to see, at least in some countries, stablecoins try to be more regulated in the sense that they hold, say, purely cash and government bonds, basically risk-free assets, and it, you know, get more introduced into the banking system.
This stability that stablecoins offer comes at a cost, though. Because a third party issue the coins, they can also be controlled by that third party.
So it's not like Bitcoin in that regard. The only resemblance it has to something like Bitcoin is that it's digital and permissionless, meaning like it can be used all around the world and you don't need ID to use it.
Alex says he's now seeing some people use Bitcoin as their savings account for long-term investments and stablecoins as a kind of checking account for quick, everyday transactions.
You start seeing these two products be used pretty closely together in a lot of places. And, you know, again, you know, a stablecoin is essentially a private sector dollar liability created outside of the regulation of the United States of America's financial system. It's like a dollar mechanism that anyone can use. But the reality is for years, it's been working as a very effective humanitarian tool in societies that are collapsing in providing dollar liquidity to people who need it.
And in the future, Lynn says that most of us will likely use a mix of these digital currencies.
I see a hybrid model being the most likely. I think out of China, we're obviously going the full central bank digital currency route. Whereas I think in United States and some other countries, I think you're more likely to see pushback against that model. And instead, at least a period of time, maybe a longer period of time, of stable coins issued by regulated entities rather than directly from the central bank. And then I think in addition to both those models existing, we're still going to see, you know, at least in some markets, we're going to see the continued existence of purely private digital currencies such as Bitcoin.
For Alex, though, as more governments issue central bank digital currencies, it's important that people can also utilize these alternative digital currencies.
Think about, you know, people who are promoting opinions that maybe the government doesn't like, right? CBDCs probably aren't going to be good for those folks. Like, you know, I doubt that an asylum seeker will have access to a Australian dollar digital account. Like, I don't think so. And guess what? What are they supposed to do if they don't have dollars anymore? Like, you know, a migrant or, you know, an asylum seeker or, you know, someone who's kind of been left out and financially excluded. Well, you know, in a digital future, they'll have Bitcoin. Like the Australian government won't be able to stop them from entering that network and using it. And that gives me a lot of hope, actually, about the future. So, you know, governments will run their course and they will experiment in this area. And we have an alternative. We have an open, neutral monetary network that anybody can access, regardless of their skin color or gender or employment or nationality or whatever. And it's the same rules for everybody. And that's a nice plan B to have. It's a nice hedge against that. So I do think in many, many ways, the next 2-3 decades will be a story of, you know, central bank digital currencies and digital fiat generally kind of versus Bitcoin and stable coins and other things. So it'll be really interesting to see this all play out.
I'm Edwina Stott, and this was Future Tense. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.